Good morning. It is Sunday morning, November 20th, 2011. Topic is Confronting Chosenness. Today's class gets to a lot more of the meat of what the class is going to be about. Some of the sources that I put included here were actually from week one. It was when I initially envisioned it, thought it would make sense really from the outset, but as people asked some really great questions about covenants, we spent what I thought, you know, necessary time going through, like spending more time and sources on the nature of the covenants, and we'll see one of the sources here again. I think we'll see several of the sources here again. Of not only what the covenant is, how the covenant operates, and can it be broken. But, you know, today this will be the last section that we'll be doing, focusing in biblical sources. We'll spend a lot of time in the rabbinic sources after this. But as a precursor, I wanted to focus on the relationship that Jews are supposed to have with non-Jews based on biblical sources. And by Jews and non-Jews, to be a little more technical, you know, it could be Israelites and non-Israelites, however one of people define the origins of Judaism. But given that, you know, we were chosen as a nation, there are other nations who, by virtue of Israel's chosenness, were not chosen. And how exactly should we interact with them, or how are we presented as, you know, Israelites and the Jewish or chosen people in relation to these other nations? That's going to be the theme today. Again, focusing on biblical sources before we get to the rabbinic period. So Ed, start us off with his Deuteronomy 10, 12 through 16. I think we've seen it. Yeah, and again, we definitely have seen this a few times, and I think we did see some of the other sources in week one.
And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God ask of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in obedience to him, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and to observe the Lord's commands and decrees that I am giving you today for your own good. To the Lord your God belong the heavens, even the highest heavens, the earth, and everything in it. Yet the Lord set his affection on your ancestors and loved them, and he chose you, their descendants, above all the nations as it is today. Circumcise your hearts, therefore, and do not be stiff-necked any longer.
Right. So, like many sources that we've seen before, an indication of God choosing the Jewish people beyond the Abrahamic covenant. And because of this covenant that we have with God, because we are chosen, there seems to be some expectation of us, in a very general sense, to fear God, walk in obedience, and to love God, to serve God with all your heart and all your soul, right? Which seems to be, you know, related to the fact that, you know, we were in fact chosen, all right? Yeah.
Good question. In the context, what does circumcise your hearts mean?
Yeah, usually means, in the context it would mean if you are... to open yourself up more fully, to remove, you know, an obstruction between you and God, and not be as stubborn in following God's ways. So, what are some of these manifestations? So, George, this is Devarim 14, 1 through 3.
You are the children of the Lord, your God. Do not cut yourselves or shave the front of your heads for the dead. For you are a people holy to the Lord, your God. Out of all the peoples on the face of the earth, the Lord has chosen you to be his treasured possession. Do not eat any detestable thing.
Right. So I think when we discussed this in week one, you know, two points wanted to make here. One is that we're told in, you know, these verses of Deuteronomy 14 that we're children for God, and we are a holy God. Not a holy God. We are a holy nation, thank you, for God. We ourselves are not holy gods. And we have been chosen, you know, by God from all the other nations. There are two things mentioned here. One immediately, like, in the context of it, and verse 3 about do not eat any detestable thing, and a few other stuff afterwards, is after, if you notice in the Hebrew, after the second pasuk, after bet, there's a samach, which indicates, for lack of a paragraph-type space in the Torah itself. And you could make reasonable derashot about whether or not this Am Kadosh sanctification thing also extends to what goes below it as a possible interpretation. And I'll throw that out there for people to consider. But certainly within, embedded within these verses, that not cutting yourselves or shaving your heads for the dead is a requirement, or is, it's a distinguishing thing that we're supposed to do, or not do as the case may be, because we are sacred and because we are, you know, chosen by God to be, you know, different. And as we mentioned in, I believe when I brought this up in week one, these were in fact Canaanite rituals, where as I said, it was when Baal, the Canaanite god, had died, his mother, cut herself and shaved the front of her head.
That's like scarring?
One is like, it seems to be the shaving part, and the other could just be like gashing. I don't know the exact details of the specs, but from what little I do know, is that there was, you know, a Canaanite ritual, so it could very well be a statement that you have, you know, in a few other places we may see, that we're not supposed to be like the Canaanite people, and this is a very specific preemptive warning. Okay? So, I mean, we can argue, like, why this of all rituals has to be mentioned in particular. But that might be a little bit more difficult to get into without spending more time in the Canaanite stuff. All I can say is one reason why you would see one specific action in contrast with being the children of God and being a holy nation to God is specifically because the Canaanite nation, or at least Canaanite people in the land that you were about to enter, did in fact do such things.
Oh, you mean I think there's an implication that he gave that land to them and they screwed up, so now...
We'll get there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's coming up.
So that means that they were the chosen people before us, by logical...
Yes and no. So that...
You've got to watch out with this guy.
Well, the truth is...
Left and right.
The truth is you're asking a really, you know, important theological question that, you know, we'll probably delve into a little bit more in the rabbinic periods and maybe in the Tuesday class too, which is, you know, what is God's interaction with the rest of the world? Meaning... It could be, yes, these people are there. Did God specifically choose them to inhabit the land? If so, was it permanent? Was it temporary? It seems to be from the text of the, you know, Bible that the children of Abraham were chosen specifically by God. Now, how God relates to the other nations in the cosmic sense, you know, you can leave as a very interesting question. And then we'll move on.
In his paragraph, it doesn't mention anything about idol worship or marrying.
We haven't gotten there yet. This is only source number two. Don't ask about omissions until we see like a whole lot more. Additionally, I'm sure. Exactly. So, you know, hold off on such questions. We will get to this. Dana, take source number three. This is Vayikra, Leviticus 24 through 28.
So, I'll take Talmud b'chol eila, ki b'chol eila, nitzvu adayim asharanim shalveyach m'shneichem. Atitma ha'aretz v'kod abona alav v'chaki ha'aretz v'shirshva v'shmarta matan ha'zchuk v'osag ha'z mishpasai v'lo sasu mikol tov v'osag eila ha'ezrach v'adger v'kagar v'sotan. Okay. I'm sorry, I should have done that in English.
I was thinking of telling you that.
It's okay. No, you know what? It's the worst thing you should do is to read a few extra psukim in Hebrew. And the truth is, the original is important, and it looks like you even left out a couple of sources that I need to add for next week, so go ahead.
So do not defile yourselves in any of these ways, because this is how the nations that I'm going to drive out before you became defiled. Even the land was defiled, so I punished it for its sins. For its sin, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. But you must keep my decrees and my laws. The native born and the foreigners residing among you must not do any of these detestable things. For all these things are done by the people who lived in the land before you, and the land became defiled. And if you defile the land, it will vomit you out as it vomited out the nations that were before you.
Right. So there seems to be here, you can say the focus is more on Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, that there's something significant to that land, such that if you behave immorally, in the context of Vayikra 18, all of these detestable things were a litany of sexual relations that were forbidden, whole bunch of them. So if you do these, well, you're going to get kicked out of the land, because it seems that the land itself cannot, you know, sustain that going on in the land.
The land doesn't have any personal feelings. It's just inert pieces of soil. So it's God that's putting this trip on.
It's the Holy Land.
There you go. In a sense, yeah. I mean, you could say that this is a metaphor or a different way of expressing an idea, but, you know, assuming, yes, it is Holy Land, holiness comes from God, and God could very well be saying, well, basically the way that I set up this holiness system is, if you do this immorality, the land itself will not be able, you know, to continue and will actually cast you out. But in particular, what I, you know, find interesting here is the contrast to the other non-Jews, or, again, the or Canaanites, whoever happened to have been there, that these other nations were accustomed to doing a whole bunch of sexual immorality. In particular, you know, this how this pasuk begins. Actually, hold on one second. All right, so the chapter pretty much begins saying, "Dabar ben Israel, tell the children of Israel, mark tell him and speak unto them, and Hashem Elokeichem, and the Lord your God, the maasei eretz Mitzrayim asher yashavtem balota asu, as the actions of the people of Egypt in which you have dwelt, do not do what they did. Ukamaasei eretz Canaan asher ani mevi etchem shama lota asu, and also like the ways of the people of Canaan, the place that I'm bringing you to, don't do what it is that they do. Do not follow in their practices or statutes." And then it goes through, you know, lists a whole bunch of the ervot.
In the beginning it says that if you defile yourself, you're not going to drive you out of the land, you become defiled. But even the land was defiled. How
yeah.
Has the land become defiled?
Great. Yeah, it's a great question. Can't get into that right now. It's would take us. It's a great question. Would take us way too off topic. Right. So there seems to be a contrast based on not so much something integral to being Jewish or not Jewish here, as opposed to here's something that, you know, more explicitly here than in the case of Lotik Godedu, of the gashing or the, you know, head buzzing thing, which I only know is from, you know, Canaanite practices because I read about Canaanite practices. It's not actually said explicitly in the Torah. You know, it's implicit, you know, that you're supposed to be sacred, which means other people who weren't chosen do this sort of thing. But here there seems to be more of a contrast, not that, you know, there's an innate superiority of, you know, Jews vis-a-vis non-Jews, as much as non-Jews, and again, I'm using this term loosely here to refer to non-Israelites, did a whole bunch of things that God in the Torah considers to be immoral, sexual practices that God considers to be immoral and abominable, and you are not supposed to do these abominable things that the other nations did. So the contrast here is everyone else is doing it, you don't do this. Yeah.
I just had an idea of what might be helpful in pointing out the way I see it. Mm. God is like a divorced husband. I divorced my last wife, the Canaanites, because they were carrying on like this. Now, second banana, I'm choosing you, and you don't do it, otherwise you'll be out also.
Well, here's the thing. We don't find in the Bible, now again,
wife in the Bible, but I...
Right, so... That's an important point to consider. Like, you could say, well, you know, I mean, this is more of a Tuesday class about fundamentals of Judaism, but yes, we're going to assume divinity of the Torah, and as such, we have no indication of God choosing other nations. It's not being mentioned there. Now, you could say, well, consider the source, yes, but, you know, it's a premise that I will be working with, that, you know, Torah is the Torah. Now, to say that God chose another nation, the Torah itself doesn't indicate that. If you go to, you know, other religions at the time, well, they're, you know, kind of polytheistic, most of them that I know of off the top of my head. But it wouldn't surprise me if at some point you had, you know, a people or even a polytheistic religion would believe that if they did certain things, they would find favor in the eyes of some deity that they considered to be God as well. You know, I'm not sure if that necessarily helps so much. The point is, you know, the God of the Hebrew Bible operates as such, in that God chooses descendants of Abraham. God gives the Torah to the subsequent descendants of Abraham. Yeah.
It seems like there are certain things God doesn't... I'm sorry, I can't think of a better word, but God doesn't approve of overall.
Mm.
And again, I know this is kind of a deeper philosophical question, but why would God allow this to exist at all?
Yeah, that is a deeper philosophical question, and the short answer is free will. Again, deep philosophical question that we can't get into here, but the super short answer is God gives people free will to do what they want to do.
Okay.
Yeah.
But if he's going to draw them out before Israel comes in, I presume that means that Israel itself will actually do the driving out. Why, if all the
we're getting there. We're getting there. Hold off on that question until the end, because I think we're going to address that by the end of the class. All right?
Okay.
So if you get, you know, make a note. If we don't get to it, bring it back later. Okay? And here, in Amos 3, we have... one through one and two. Here, this word, people of Israel, the word of the Lord is spoken up against you, against the whole family brought out of Egypt. You only I have chosen of all the families of earth, therefore I will punish you for all your sins. And here we have a different way of, you know, exploring this idea of chosenness vis-a-vis non-Jews, not so much in terms of, you know, being special and treasured, but that we're actually going to be held accountable for the sins that we do. Which does pose a very interesting contrast, I think, to what we saw in source number 3 from Vayikra, of, you know, the land driving out certain, you know, certain nations that did sexual immorality, which would seem to imply that you know, even other nations are in fact punished for their sins. According to this passage in Amos, these two paragraphs, it seems that what makes the Jewish people unique and distinct is that we are in fact punished for our sins. Yeah.
There was a movie I saw years ago, The Devil's Disciple, or something like that.
Devil's Advocate?
Devil's Advocate, where Italian Al Pacino plays Satan.
Ah, spoilers for anyone who watched.
And he says, yeah, God, he sets up the universe in a way that, you know, you got all these urges that you can look but don't touch. You can sniff but don't grab. And all these... temptations that he sets out before you. So, like, what kind of a God is this? He's a tempter.
He's a tease.
Yeah.
He's checking you out. It's a test.
Yeah, but I don't see anything virtuous about that particular role. He could have.
He's setting up a system by which we're rewarded for our restraint.
Yeah, it's like people have to walk around tied up with filling and tzitzis and all this kind of stuff, and don't be natural.
That is certainly a perspective. It's something that we will be getting to in the Tuesday class, and probably spend at least one class on stuff like that. So consider it a plug.
You're getting tied up with tzitzis, you're doing it wrong.
Also true. So moving on to the next section, this actually should be, you know, section 2. You know, we had a few sources here on what, you know, makes the Jewish people distinct very specifically from the non-Jews. In this next section, wanted to cover some sources of, well, what is life like living amongst non-Jews or non-Israelites? It's a fair point. What seem to be the biggest concerns? So I'll do this one because it's a little bit long. This is Devarim chapter 7, Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 12. When the Lord your God brings you into the land, you are entering to possess and drives out before you the many nations, Hittites, Girgashi, Amori, Kanani, Prizi, Chibi, Yubusi, sorry, Caesar in the Hebrew for me, seven nations larger and stronger than you. The Lord your God has delivered them over to you. You have defeated them. You must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them and show them no mercy. Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons. For they will turn your children away from following me to serve other gods. And the Lord's anger will burn against you and will quickly destroy you. This is what you are to do to them. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, cut down their Asherah poles, burn their idols in the fire. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, his treasured nation, his treasured possession. So it seems from this particular source that the ideal when you move into the land of Israel is to wipe out all the non-Israelites. Seems to be the main concern is, if you integrate too much, if you intermarry, in particular, specifically intermarry, the non-Israelites, or the various Canaanite nations, are going to influence you as a nation and turn you to other gods. And that the concern is, by too much integration, you're going to follow other gods, thus turning your back from God. You're not convinced.
No, I'm very much convinced. But, there's an argument there for more separatism than not not intermarrying.
Well, I mean, this is kind of explicit here about, destroying. I mean, when it says this is what you should do to them, break down all their altars, smash their sacred stones, there's a general purge here, if not of the nations themselves, genocide, then of, cultural destruction, meaning anything that you see, if there's any relic of any relic of idolatry ought to be wiped out completely. Is apparently, if it's going to be there, the concern is, well, you are in fact going to be tempted to worship these other gods. And note, it was only relatively modern phenomena that we saw in the Politics of Exclusion class. For the people at this time, it wasn't an issue of believe in God or don't believe in anything. It doesn't appear in this culture that atheism was really an option, but it was rather which deities are you actually going to follow? Yeah.
Seven nations occupy the land of Israel? That's a lot. It sounds like an awful lot for that relatively small piece of land.
Must these were wider mother at that time.
They fought against five in the Yom Kippur War.
Well, for I would refer you to the Book of Joshua. Normally, I wish the Atlas.Mikra came out. Actually, if the Atlas.Mikra did come out in English, I would recommend anyone get it. But in Hebrew, it's one of the best things where traces out based on the verses who is where geographically in the land. It's a wonderful read in Hebrew. I understand if not everyone can do it. If anyone wishes to put in a request, for the English, and if it does come in English, if anyone's listening, please let me know, and that way I can endorse it to people. But it would help answer your question in terms of seven nations, because when you think about a nation or an you don't necessarily know how big it is. For all you know, it could just be a
conversion. It says that they're larger.
Larger than you.
Larger than you.
Yeah. Now you could even, seven. Yeah.
What kind of lesson is this? You live among these other people, destroy their property.
Kill
them. And kill them, and yet live among them. He's basically telling the Jews to pick a serious fight.
Well, the point is,
and then somehow continue to live
among them. So that it seems to be a weird,
seems to be.
Let's explore that for a second. Because on one hand, ideally, the Jewish people ought to wipe out the entire nation. But if they're supposed to wipe out a nation, like they're supposed to take over completely the land of Israel. Now, if you do that, no one else is there, then all of these warnings are going to be moot, aren't they? Because no one else is going to be there.
Yeah.
So perhaps is the Bible anticipating, perhaps, that the Jews are not, in fact, going to succeed in wiping out? Because if you have wiped them out, then there's no stumbling block.
I can see how this particular passage influences contemporary Jews in the United States
where you got groups like the Lubavitch or Hasidic groups. We have to stick together. We got to be on our own and forget the Goyim and their corrupting ways.
Well, that's,
and blah, blah, blah.
That's stuff that we're going to get much, 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 much later. Today,
it could lead to anti-Semitism and people saying, keep the Jews out of your land because they're going to try to wipe you out.
So the truth is, if you're viewing it based on the biblical source, I mean, this is in a way, though, a fixed point in time. This is when the Jewish people are about to enter the land of Israel.
Yeah.
Now, you fast forward, you know, a few thousand years, you get to say the rabbinic period, that, again, we're going to be spending a lot of time on, and a lot of this stuff gets extrapolated because the rabbinic sages did, in fact, need to live in, you know, amongst non-Jews and amongst various other regimes.
So they said, forget about Deuteronomy 7?
No, it's not forget about Deuteronomy 7 as much as the commandment was for the Jews that were entering the land of Israel were to wipe out everyone else. Now, does this apply today where we have to go in? So the truth is there are some fundamentalists who do, in fact, say such things. I don't believe that that's actually what is, you know, I mean, we can get into what's actually mandated based on halakhic sources later and how we interact. Now, do people go to an extreme? Yes. Is that the majority opinion that I know of, even from Orthodox Jews? Not to my knowledge. But, you know, we could argue about that at length elsewhere. But that is a good point that helps, you know, is one of the reasons why I'm doing, you know, this class, because you know, you look at such statements, well, you know, maybe that does mean we are supposed to, like, wipe out any non-Jewish inhabitant in the land of Israel, and I'm sure there are some whack jobs who think of that today. I happen to be not among them, but we'll get, again, you know, things we're sort of anticipating.
God wiped out cities before in the time of Abraham. Mm. So if these are so abominable behaviors, why does God just destroy them?
Well,
then there isn't a question that Israel coming into land has to do this.
So that gets into a more complicated dynamic about Israel's role, and especially coming into the land of Israel, where thematically it seems that Israel is, you know, it's not that, you know, God's going to do everything for you, but rather people are supposed to, you know, earn, you know, what it is they're supposed to be given. Take source number 6. This is Devarim 18, 9 through 14.
When you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you, do not learn to imitate the detestable ways of the nations there. Let no one be found among you who sacrifices their son or daughter in the fire, who practices divination or sorcery, interprets omens, engages in witchcraft, or casts spells, or who is a medium or spiritist, or who consults the dead. Anyone who does these things is detestable to the Lord, because the same detestable practices the Lord your God, because of these same detestable practices, the Lord your God will drive out those nations before you. You must be blameless before the Lord your God. The prophet... Huh?
Oh, I'm sorry, that's a heading. We should probably delete that.
The nations you will dispossess, listen to those who practice sorcery or divination, but as for you, the Lord your God has not permitted you to do so.
Mm-hmm. So here, again, there are concerns, you know, that you might call under detestable is to'avot ha'goyimahim, the abomination, the abominations, detestable ways of the nations who are there, involving what you might call idolatrous practice, not necessarily of worshiping other gods, but various forms of divination and sorcery and the like. We actually spoke about one of them over Shabbos. Yeah.
God isn't telling us that these things are invalid or don't work. Elsewhere, aren't we also told not to practice astrology? But we're not necessarily told it's malarkey, just that we're not supposed to use...
Well, based on these psukim, you don't have it... What, you're right. Based on these psukim, you don't have one way or the other. Just as regard, you know, you just can't do this. I'm not sure what difference that makes practically here, other than the actions themselves, even if somehow metaphysically they are effective, you're still not allowed to do them.
Right.
Which, you know, is still, you know, for the purposes of this conversation, doesn't really change one thing or another. But it does remind us that these are things that the non-Jews or the non-Israelites who happen to be in the land of Egypt do these things, and you're not supposed to do these things that they are doing.
No, but it does lend some legitimacy, at least for them. We're not saying that whatever it is they engage in is totally bogus, so much as it's not for us.
But again, doesn't matter for the whole chosenness part. The chosenness part is we're supposed to do what God tells us to do and not do a whole bunch of other things.
Yeah.
And the primary concern that I see, at least in the Torah, is... or at least God's main concern is, the more you have the non-Israelite culture around you, the more you will be tempted to worship other gods and take you away from solely worshiping God. Because you saw the whole Elkanah thing. God is a, just a slight digression here. It's because you're doing two classes at the same time. They're kind of related. Sometimes I forget what I say in one and what I say in the other. So if I didn't do it here, please correct me. Otherwise, consider it incentive, if you're listening to follow both classes. God wants you to follow only God. And that's it. And the concern seems to be with too much integration or too much parallel, too much living in parallel with the non-Israelites, you are going to be led astray. What does led astray mean? Worshipping and following other gods. And it seems like, Shatnez, is something I throw out. It doesn't seem to be a main concern. It's like, oh, you're not going to follow Shatnez. It seems to be like actually, more sacrificial and more ritual worship towards other deities or other supernatural metaphysical, actions or attempted metaphysical supernatural actions.
It's not what?
One second. George first, then Ed.
Why would multiple gods be more tempting than one god?
That's a fascinating question there. Why would you follow, what advantage would be to one to the other?
They are brought out of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
They're given the Torah, and there's smoke and fire, and they're taken through the desert.
What's the attraction? Not having lived at the time, I can't really say. There's a Gemara we can see about that, about removing the temptation for Avodah Zarah, because apparently it was stronger. To throw out a couple of possibilities here, perhaps the actual rituals themselves were more enjoyable. All right, and if you can enjoy, you're doing some spiritual worship, but one way is more personally enjoyable than another, you'd do that. Two. If everyone else around you is doing something, it's very tempting to say, well, hey, let me try that out. That seems a little more interesting. And you could say, yes, if you really want to get philosophical, today, we can, I think we can be removed enough. We can be removed enough from being in a purely religious mind that we can say, well, what's the difference? But then it's like, hey, this is what we have, but let's experiment, with the other stuff.
Also an issue of peer pressure, maybe not so much in New York, but you can bet in Iowa or something.
Perhaps, if you're talking about it from, just a spiritual curiosity thing. Now, again, atheism or non-religion wasn't so much of an option. By option, I don't mean in theory people could have, but that wasn't really how people operated back in the day. So, let's say something doesn't work. Here's something else. Let's say the world doesn't work the way that you'd like it to. So say, this God isn't helpful. Let me try someone else. Idol worshiping can be a lot easier because it gives you a focus instead of believing in a God that has no body or no form. An issue that comes up in Sefer Melachim repeatedly are the Bamot. Before the Beit HaMikdash was built, people were allowed to bring sacrifices in their backyard, have their own little barbecues. Once the Beit HaMikdash was built, people had to go to a centralized location. When you have Bamot, you were able to have more localized cults and kind of do your own thing without having to go through the bureaucracy of the Kohanim or whoever was running the temple. And still that would go against the word of God, and that gets repeated that even the good kings mentioned in Sefer Melachim in the Book of Kings, Rakabamot Lasaru, main thing that they that they didn't do was they weren't able to get rid of all of these private stuff. So You know, there are a lot of ways to not follow God or to do things differently. Some of them, you know, might seem more subtle than others in terms of, you know, having your own sacrificial stuff in your backyard as opposed to actively worshiping Baal. But, you know, when you consider Avodah Zarah in a broad sense of doing strange or foreign worship, or worship that God did not command, or worship that God commanded you not to do, right, would still come under that category.
You mentioned about atheists not being an option or mentioned. Interestingly, if Islam's view of everybody else is that the Jews and the Christians got it wrong, the atheists just haven't gotten it yet.
Yes, but when did Islam come up compared to, say, biblical?
Their current view of other religions is you got it wrong. Therefore, you're worse than the guy who just hasn't gotten it yet.
Dan, take source number 7, 7a and 7b. This first Devarim 17.
When you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you, and you have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, let us set a king over us like all the nations around us. Be sure to appoint over you a king the Lord your God chooses. He must be from among your fellow Israelites. Do not place a foreigner over you, one who is not an Israelite.
I can do 7b. This is Shmuel Aleph 8, 19, and 20.
But the people refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said, we want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and fight our battles.
So, you know, there's a lot that's written on this particular, you know, on these two verses, where in Devarim, we're, you know, so it's almost predictive that once you're in the land of Israel, you're going to say, you know, Asima alai melch kachol guyim asher sevivotai, you know, appoint for us a king like the other nations around us. And people actually say something to that effect in Shmuel, right before the appointing of Shaul HaMelech, Vayinu gam anachnu kechol ha-goyim. And behold, we will be like the other nations. And, you know, there's commentaries, you know, have a field day with this in terms of trying to figure out why in the book of Shmuel they were kind of chastised for doing this, even though the Bible kind of says, hey, here's what, you know, you guys are going to say. One distinction just to throw out here, it says, Yetzal lefanenu v'nilcham et milchotenu, he will go out in front of us and fight our battles. Now, this kind of goes into something that, George, you mentioned earlier in terms of why doesn't God just take care of things for us. So, in the readings of, say, the conquest of Joshua in particular and a few others, the Jews don't just go out to battle and fight. God goes out with them and fights with the Jewish people. So it's not that it's not that God is going to, like, take care of it entirely on his own. There has to be, you know, for lack of a better term, a partnership, yeah, between them. So one complaint here isn't that, you know, you want to be like the other non-Jews, but you want to be like the other non-Jews and not like the other nations around you, kechol goyim, like the other nations, in that you're putting pretty much all of your might about, you know, judging and being a king and going out to war in the hands of this human king, as opposed to relying on God. One of several interpretations on here. But, you know, the mere fact biblically of kechol goyim asher sevivotai itself in the Bible doesn't seem to be criticized that much, or at least, you know, even if there's some frowning upon of it in some level, it's clearly not prohibited, right? And God actually says, well, here's the, you know, here are the requirements for a king, which means not everything that not the other nations do is intrinsically invalid just because they do them. You know, we may even spend a shiur on getting to the rabbinic period of, like, what is chukat ha-goy, you know, doing these things, you know, the non-Jewish stuff, but it doesn't mean, like, oh, just because the non-Jews do it is therefore intrinsically bad. This does give you one example of something where, you know, again, even if God frowns upon it, there seems to be some worst case scenario, meaning one opinion, one way of approaching this is, yeah, this is a perfectly fine, legitimate request. Another approach is, well, you really shouldn't do it, but God's going to give in anyway and say, well, you know, throw you a bone on this one. But even if God's just throwing you a bone on this one, well, the fact, you know, God could just as easily say, no, you cannot have a king. Right, so there does seem to be, even if you want to view this in the most restrictive possible way and the most critical way, God still offers a little bit of leeway, which, given God's, you know, you know, God's not shy about saying what you should do and what you should not do, I think is itself significant.
Provides several things for people. One, it unites them.
Yeah.
There's a central figure for judicial review of things. There's leadership in terms of war and battle and taking care of those things. So why is there this reluctance to say,
In Shmuel?
Yeah.
I need a lot more time to go through that. But I can say that there is, the question is valid. The question is wonderful. A lot of commentators and a lot of the Midrashim offer different approaches to that question that is beyond the scope of what we can do now, but would be a nice exercise for future learning. And the best way to do this is, to find commentaries on that verse that will describe that very question. And, the reason why I put these in juxtaposition is specifically because it does seem sanctioned by the Torah itself, so why is there a problem? Anyway, I think we're up to you, George. Source 8. This is Devarim 9, 4 through, what is it? Six. Yeah.
After the Lord your God has driven them out before you, do not say to yourself, the Lord has brought me here to take possession of this land because of my righteousness. No, it is on account of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is going to drive them out before you. It is not because of your righteousness or your integrity that you are going to take possession of this land, of their land, but on account of the wickedness of these nations. The Lord your God will drive them out before you to accomplish what he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Understand then that it is not because of your righteousness that the Lord your God is giving you this good land to possess, for you are a stiff-necked people.
I thought it was important including this here, because if you're going to view, some sense of Jewish superiority, I know we've seen the source before. I mean, there are some great passages here. I mean, this is also from Akev, my Bar Mitzvah Parsha. So, there's a personal connection I have. It's a way of almost, checking your ego at the door. You're going to come in, you're going to conquer it. But do not think that it's because you're so great. It's only because everyone else is that much worse. And I do think that is important, at least from a psychological perspective, of entering the land of Israel. Like, it is possible to get so worked up over your chosenness. And so it's like, this is our... And I was like, ease up there. And 9a and 9... so let's do 9a. This is Devarim 12, 29 through 31. Lord your God will cut off before you the nations you are about to invade and dispossess, but when you have driven them out and settled in their land, and after they have been destroyed before you, be careful not to be ensnared about their gods, saying, how do these nations serve their gods? We will do the same. This gets back to your point of the curiosity thing of just what was this culture around here. You must not worship the Lord your God in their way, because in worshiping their gods, they do all kinds of detestable things the Lord hates. They even burn their sons and daughters in the fire as sacrifices to God. We've seen, this theme repeated before. I included this here in particular because you have that... there's a concern, even after you've wiped them out, that you would sort of backtrack and say, well, what did the indigenous population do? And sort of seek out after that as almost a historical curiosity. With that, I wanted to juxtapose Shoftim, the book of Judges 3, 1 and 2, because I think this is just phenomenal based on everything that we've seen. In Lagoyim Asher, Hiniach Hashem Lenasot Bam et Yisrael, Et Kol Asher Lo Yadu Et Kol Milchamot Kanaan. These are the nations the Lord left to test all those Israelites who had not experienced any of the wars in Canaan. He did this only to teach warfare to the descendants of the Israelites who had not had previous battle experience. So we were talking, we mentioned this idea of, if you're going to wipe out all the other nations, why are you concerned with following them? And according to, the book of Judges 3, Shoftim 3, 1 and 2, that God intentionally left nations in the land of Israel. Even though we were supposed to wipe them out entirely, God did us a favor by not helping us wipe out everyone there. Why? So we should ever remain vigilant and not forget how to actually wage war. It is a very curious, you know, pasuk here, two pasukim, given the risks of Avodah Zarah that God is clearly concerned with throughout the Torah, and particularly in the book of Devarim, to say, well, oh, you know, better off that we have these people here and I'll sort of, you know, trust you not to mess up. You know, that didn't really work out so well. So I'm not entirely sure what to make of this pasuk, but it does lead to, I think, some really, really fascinating questions, you know, biblically, theologically, of, how, logically even, too, of how does this actually make sense with everything else. But again, just to summarize briefly, the main concern that I see in terms of the Jews and non-Jews or Israelites vis-a-vis the non-Israelites in the Bible is do not do what the other nations did. The ideal is not to live amongst the non-Israelites, but rather to wipe them out. The primary concern being idolatry, or in the broad sense, meaning either worshiping their gods or performing spiritual rituals that God finds detestable, like the sorcery and the divination and the like, and also concerns about sexual immorality that seem to have been prevalent at the time. Sexual immorality as defined by immoral based on what the biblical God says is immoral. Those seems to be God's issues with integrating with the non-Jews. Again, being led away from God, worshiping other gods, seeking out some metaphysical, spiritual divinations that would take you away from God, and concerns with sexual immorality. Primary focus of Jews versus non-Jews or Israelites and non-Israelites, purely on the biblical sources of what would make us distinct from the other nations of the land that we would be about to enter. All right? And next week we will start, you know, a whole bunch of different ideas in the rabbinic sources, where we will not only explore some of these ideas in terms of Midrashim, like how did the sages interpret the chosenness part, how did the sages interpret the the Britot, but also more details of practical matters of, you know, interactions between, you know, Jews and non-Jews that, you know, not only are they, you know, in terms of practical halacha that we maintain today, but were also made in a very different world. For one, they were instituted by rabbis, not directly word from God. I mean, you had rabbis that were trying to interpret the word of God, but they were also reflecting a very different reality. At, you know, the biblical stage of Jewish history, you know, there was supposed to be a very linear trajectory, which, you know, we spoke about here at some point in Shul, about, you know, the three mitzvot in the order that the Jewish people were supposed to do. You know, come in, you know, conquer the land, put up a king, you know, build a Beit Hamikdash, and smooth sailing from there. Clearly that didn't happen. And the world in which the sages lived was very different. You're talking about living after, you know, at least one destruction of the temple, possibly two, depending in which, you know, what rabbi you're speaking about. It meant, you know, not having the political or military might that, you know, you did, you know, in the biblical time. So you're dealing with a very different world. You may argue a more pragmatic world that would certainly be more like what we have today than the biblical. If you're going to set a parallel between, you know, important Jewish texts and our society of living as Jewish people today, we probably have more in common with the rabbinic society than we would in the biblical one, for, you know, the aforementioned reasons. So we've got a lot to do there. We can take it from a lot of different angles. And, you know, here we can really open a lot more in terms of requests, because, you know, the rabbinic literature is, you know, really huge on this. So I'm looking forward. Have a wonderful week. And if anyone's following the Tuesday class, this Tuesday we will be discussing in Fundamentals of Judaism in, you know, a sense of more of what God wants. But, you know, if you're following that, you'll know what that means. And have a great week, and see you soon, hopefully.